From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1960s, Jonathan Kozol produced a book-length dispatch about his first year teaching in a Boston public school. It was a vivid portrait of institutional racism and Kozol's own moral indignation. 40 years later, on the other side of busing and the integration movement, Kozol is still fighting for equality and opportunity in America's public schools. And the country, he charges, is backsliding in its urban schools, all the way to what he calls educational apartheid. In Chicago, public schools are 87% black or Hispanic. In Washington, D.C., 94%. Detroit, 96%. And from the Bronx to Seattle, says Kozol, the president's No Child Left Behind Act is not offsetting the impact of 21st century American segregation. Critics say he's wrong, and we'll hear that. Kozol says he's right, and he says it with moral fury. This hour on Point, Jonathan Kozol on the segregation of America's urban schools. You can join the conversation. Apartheid schooling? Do you see it? Is No Child Left Behind the answer? Is it busing time again? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Jonathan Kozol. His Death at an Early Age won the National Book Award in 1968. His book, Savage Inequalities, about failures in the American educational system, was published in 1991. He's had a string of other books, all of them rock readers. His new book is The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. Jonathan Kozol, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So there are some of the numbers, but paint the picture more broadly for us. These are very high. These are nearing 100% black and brown, as you put it, black and Hispanic in many urban schools. Is it so much so that it justifies the apartheid?
Absolutely, absolutely. Segregation has returned with a vengeance to public education in the past 15 years. The proportion of black kids who now go to integrated schools is back where it was in 1968.
And when you say that, do you mean across all schools or simply urban schools?
No, public schools, period.
Period.
And it's back where it was in 1968, the year that Dr. King was killed. Tom, as you know, I've just visited 60 schools across the country in the inner city schools. It's not just that these schools are kind of segregated. You never see any white children in these schools. I'll go into a school with 2,000 black and Latino kids, and maybe there are 6 white kids and 3 Asians. Typical schools in the South Bronx are 99.8% black and Latino. So if you want to be precise, you could say 0.2 of one percentage point mark the difference between legally enforced apartheid in the South 50 years ago and socially and economically enforced apartheid in all these major northern cities now. In fact, if you took a photo of the typical class I visit, it would look exactly like those photographs from old textbooks of classrooms in Mississippi in 1925.
0.2%, and you point out the irony that many of these urban schools bear the names of the leaders of the civil rights movement from Martin Luther King to Thurgood Marshall.
Absolutely.
And who fought against exactly this picture.
Yeah, one of the great ironies is that if I come to a city and I ask, you know, I'm going to visit the schools, teachers say to me, if you want to see a really segregated school, just ask for one that's named for Dr. King. Boston has a Martin Luther King school. I'm old enough, so I remember the day it was dedicated. I drove by it recently, 98% black and Hispanic. New York City has a Martin Luther King High School right at Lincoln Center, which is, for those who don't know, is the very center of the most beautiful upscale section of Manhattan. It was built there so that whites could walk to it from their homes.
Yes.
White people have abandoned it. It's about 99% black and Latino. There are schools like this everywhere in the United States. I sometimes wonder why we name, and most of these, to be honest,
yes,
are awful schools. I mean, these are the schools that have the lowest funding, usually the highest biggest class size and the worst results. So I always wonder why we name these schools for people that black folks love. I always think we ought to name them for people they don't like.
There's a kind of almost mockery in there. You say...
Yeah, like name the school for William Bennett or Clarence Thomas, or somebody they don't love.
Someone who wishes or speculates about them having not been born. You describe segregation as a word that we really ought to be using in this country now. It's a word that has this historical patina about it. You say, no, segregation is real. It's 21st century. It's today.
Absolutely. And I mean, I go out of my way to say this, and I know that a lot of the media will probably criticize me for saying this, because what tends to happen is major newspapers in the United States officially deplore segregation everywhere in the United States. They simply never mention it in their own front yard. Typically, when they refer to their own school systems, they'll say, we serve a diverse population. And this, they'll use the word diverse to describe a 99% black and Latino school.
Diverse.
So, yeah, so diverse has really come to be a synonym, a euphemism for segregation. But just one other point I want to add quickly. It's not simply that we ripped apart the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education. Mm-hmm. We haven't even lived up to the tarnished promises of Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1896 decision that said schools could be segregated but must at least be equal.
Separate but equal would work.
These schools are blatantly segregated. That's obvious if you walk with me through any of these schools, where you jump if you see a white student. Mm-hmm. You wonder where he came from. Mm-hmm. But they're also grossly unequal. And I'll give the simplest of examples. In New York City, for example, little kids that I've been writing about for years in the South Bronx, black and Latino kids, they get about $11,000 a year put into their public education.
That's not nothing.
No, but it isn't, of course. But the cost of living in New York is so high, that's like about $8,000 anywhere else.
Okay.
Anyway, say $11,000. Mm-hmm. For these little kids like Pineapple, this little girl that has sort of taken over my past three books because she bosses me around and she always says, I want to be on the cover of your book, and I obey her because she's so cleverly manipulative. Yes. I love little kids like that. Anyway, there's little Pineapple. In fact, I'll just have to say parenthetically, Pineapple is so bossy, and successfully so, that when Hillary Clinton, came up with me to visit the neighborhood sometime
ago. At which school?
This is a school called PS65 in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. When Hillary came up with me to visit the kids some years ago, and Robert Novak, a reporter, was sort of standing behind her in the picture. Mm-hmm. Pineapple points to him and says, you, get out of the way. And he obeyed her. Anyway, the little Pineapple's getting $11,000 a year.
Yep.
You lift her up in your grown-up arms and you plunk her down in the first suburb just to the north of the Bronx.
The inner ring.
It's called Bronxville, where famous college Sarah Lawrence is. Mm-hmm. It's 10 minutes from her home. Mm-hmm. This isn't an hour's bus ride. Mm-hmm. 10 minutes from her home, she'd be, instead of $11,000 a year, she'd be getting $19,000 a year.
And yet you say, Jonathan Kozol, that Americans have come to kind of see this as okay. There's a psychological sort of backflip that you described that has somehow taken the sting or the urgency out of our conversations around segregation. What's the dynamic there that you see?
Well, frankly, I don't think that – I mean, I think you have to make a real distinction here. I don't think that most Americans at heart are selfish or certainly overtly racist people. And I think that most Americans, if they met Pineapple, would do anything they could to give her the same blessings they give their own kids.
But 40 years ago, the country was marching in the streets about segregation, and now it's not.
Well,
why? If you're right.
Well, the distinction I make is between the sentiments of ordinary people when they actually are exposed to these children and official government policy, which pretty much locks in place the kind of segregation that makes it impossible for them ever to know Pineapple.
But Americans elect their governments. They basically know what government policy is.
Still, the people we elect are capable of eliciting the best motives, the best inclinations in a population or the meanest motives.
But do you think, Jonathan Kozol, that Americans have embraced a return to segregation, or they know it's out there, but they think, we tried integration, we tried busing, we tried, it didn't work, it's time for something else, and so they're lining up with President Bush on testing and No Child Left Behind?
No, I don't think that's true. I think the majority of people I see everywhere in the country, and I've, you know, just been back and forth across the country now for a month, and I'm seeing larger audiences than I've seen at any time since 1968. Mm-hmm. They're not simply young liberal college kids. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are Republicans, mainstream Americans. Most Americans would reflect the same words that I quote from a wealthy suburban mother in Ohio who said, Jonathan, it bothers my conscience. We wouldn't play Little League baseball this way. It's unacceptable to me. It is government policy, and it is the culture warriors who dominate the discourse in New York and Washington who have presented this false image that that integrated schooling failed, which is a preposterous misreading of history, and that it's time, you know, therefore it's time to see if we can have happy segregation instead.
Happy segregation being we won't integrate, but we'll test, and the testing will produce a good education for
exactly.
everyone. We'll guarantee.
Basically, the entire agenda of President Bush, which is supported by a lot of conservatives and former liberals, is give up on an integrated society, but by drilling kids relentlessly for examinations, by proto-military curricula in which they don't read literature but are essentially given scripted materials to march them along to the next exam, we will pump the test scores a few percentage points each year for segregated children, and we'll achieve something that you might call perfectible apartheid.
And we'll be okay. You know, you have even black critics who say that they've got to go that way. We're talking this hour with Jonathan Kozol. His new book is The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. You can join the conversation. Did America march through the civil rights era, then turn away and let schools resegregate? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the resegregation of America's urban schools and its meaning for the country. My guest is Jonathan Kozol, author of the new book, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. You can join us. Apartheid schooling? Do you see it? Is that a fair description? If segregation was bad in 1965, is it okay in 2005? And have we turned a blind eye to the color of America's urban schools? Does it matter? We're 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Kozol, we're going to hear some pushback to your perspective and your prescriptions in a few minutes, and we're going to talk about answers to what you've seen. But I wish you'd bring us some of the realities, first of all. Just make this more real for us. For one thing, outcomes, how are they? And what about this proto-military curricula what do you mean by that?
Well, first on the outcomes, the fact of the matter is that during the three decades of continuous and successful integration of our schools up until about 1990, the achievement gap between black and white children narrowed consistently and dramatically. Since 1990, since this sweeping return to segregation, the race gap has widened again. And at the present time, it's as wide as it was at the end of the integration era. So we've been
at the end, or
well, about 1990 is when the U.S. Supreme Court began to cut back, dismantle Brown, essentially. So what you see today in the I just might add, every few years you'll read in the newspapers a little hopeful story like this. A blip in fourth grade reading scores for minority children. Scores are up 3 percentage points. And the press celebrates these tiny and almost always ephemeral gains. 3 years later, we read, there was a mistake. The test, it was a new test. It was easier. scores down again.
It was a wrinkle.
These are false promises. Now, I've been at this for 40 years, Tom, I've seen a lot of false promises. If these alleged gains in fourth grade, which are due to nonstop drilling for exams, if these were real gains, they would persist. But I see the same kids 4 years later when they're in eighth grade, and they can't write a cogent sentence.
So you're a skeptic on the test results that are the hallmark of No Child Left Behind, but you're also a critic and skeptic on the process that gets kids to whatever test results they produce. And describe that for us. Describe, what do you mean when you say proto-military curriculum?
Okay, let me be precise. In order to pump the test scores a couple points each year, because inner-city principals are terrorized now by No Child Left Behind, because if they can't show a, you know, like a 3 percentage point gain or something like that,
hit the mark or you're in trouble.
Yeah, they're punished. In order to cope with this, many inner-city principals, including some of the best ones I know, are forcing their teachers essentially to read scripted lesson plans in which the teachers are unable to say anything that they learned in college or thought of spontaneously that morning. A teacher cannot discuss something exciting that happened on the weekend, even a news event. She's got to stick to that script.
Absolutely ironclad, even minute by minute.
That's right. I've watched third grade teachers holding timers in their hands, because otherwise what they call the curriculum cops will come by and notice that they're not on the right paragraph at the right moment.
You've reported that a teacher couldn't even bring a pumpkin into the classroom in the fall because it didn't fall into a curriculum.
The poor teacher, that was in Sacramento, the poor teacher wanted to bring a pumpkin for Halloween, and she was told, she was asked, well, will that meet the national standards? So she figured out a way to do it. She devised something she called the multimodal pumpkin unit, in which she forced the pumpkin to fit into Mr. Bush's various categories of standards.
It makes it almost funny, but what you describe, the atmosphere you describe, is not exactly funny. You say that the testing and drilling is producing a generation of kind of robotic children.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're passing the test. What's the robotic part here?
And I'm not basing this, by the way, on any kind of abstract studies from think tanks or Washington institutes. I've watched dozens of these classes taking place. The kids are, because the timing is so tight, and because not only the teachers' questions are scripted, but the children's answers are scripted also. Teacher is told what the child has to answer.
And tells the child what to answer, and the child answers that
way. Yeah, and then the child, and they do a lot of chanting back and forth where the child keep chanting it back. There's absolutely no opportunity for the child, number one, to think, to ask any kind of discerning questions that the script writers haven't thought of in advance, nor is there any opportunity in most of these schools for kids to read real literature. Now, because the scripted material, which is obsessively consumed with sound, with phonics, and I'm not opposed to phonics, by the way, as long as it's not done with a kind of religious fanaticism.
But it's phonics to get the reading done, to mechanically work through the sentence.
I've taught phonics. I taught it in inner city Boston, suburban Newton. I'm not one of those like wheat germ people who think you can't teach kids anything. I've taught phonics, but phonics has to be taught in the context of good literature so that children understand why they're learning to read. The trouble here is we have a generation of inner city kids right now, I see every day, who are growing up without any exposure to the treasures of literature, whether it's the beautiful little picture books of Eric Carle, like The Very Hungry Caterpillar, or whether it's the soft perplexities of Pooh and the tragical pronouncements of Eeyore and Piglet. They're growing up divorced from all of this beauty in order that their principals can report a 2% gain in phonetic reading skills.
But if they can do the reading, writing, and arithmetic, isn't that the kind of actual hard base that they need? I mean, do you not fall into President Bush's bigotry of soft expectations?
No, first of all, I'm a tough teacher, and black parents have always, the parents of my kids have always been grateful that I don't believe in just fooling around with kids and just being beautiful or something. No. I'm a strict, tough teacher. I want kids to succeed. But the fact is, the alleged testing gains, a couple points that Mr. Bush claims, are not real gains. They're They're testing games, yes. They're not learning games.
And you say they don't stick even at the testing.
Well, the most obvious result is this. We've had 10 years of this now because this has been going on in many states like New York and Massachusetts, California, long before Mr. Bush's law was passed. The average 12th grade black and Latino child in America today reads and writes at the level of the average white 7th grader. If Mr. Bush's plan, if this severe agenda for basically providing, nonstop and obsessive, even I call it sociopathological testing and terror as a substitute for equality, if this were successful, we would have seen the results
But
by
the
now.
Country looks to it in part, I think, because you've got to do something. What are you suggesting? Let the buses roll again? Is it,
I'm suggesting a
new
of
era
things.
Of busing? What?
First of all, I'm suggesting that teachers themselves, who are the best witnesses to what's going on, and I don't merely meet thousands of young teachers. I recruit them everywhere I go. If I meet exciting seniors at the best colleges in America, I ruin their lives by saying, don't go to business school or law school. Go into an inner city school and teach. And thousands do.
But you're pretty critical of a lot of teachers
in
those schools.
These teachers call me on the phone 2 or 3 years later in tears. They are ready to walk out and they are ready to rise up in a massive protest movement against number one, the gross segregation, which stuns them because they thought that was over 40 years ago, to the blatant inequalities, which they can't miss because they went to good schools, and three, against this testing nightmare, which turns these teachers into robots.
So you're saying reintegrate what? Pour money in and pay the teachers more?
I make three strong suggestions at the end of this book. Number one, so long as we're going to have segregated schools, these schools don't just need as much money as the wealthy suburbs. They need far more because they are getting kids whose problems are infinitely greater, and they're also usually getting kids who have had no pre-K education.
So more money than the burbs, number one, two?
Number two, if we should be sending them the most experienced, highly talented teachers, not the least experienced.
Which you say they're getting now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If these young volunteers in programs like Teach for America, for example, want to do some good in the world, instead of flooding into the segregated ghetto schools where they are totally inexperienced and are drowning, they ought to be sent to the richest schools to free up better, more experienced teachers to go to the ghetto.
And number three, buses again, reintegrate?
And number three, we need a massive national assault on residential and school segregation. The best way to fight it is by breaking the back of the persistent redlining, which keeps our suburbs lily white. But in the interim, for now, there is ample evidence that a good short-term solution is to allow kids from the inner city voluntarily to ride a bus to go to the kinds of schools that George Bush and I attended when we were little boys. And I might just add to that I'm not talking about forced busing. I'm talking about these many very successful voluntary city suburban integration programs that exist across the country.
So let those urban kids flow out to suburban schools.
They ought to be mightily expanded. There's a program like that in Boston, includes 30 of the top suburbs. I've taught in this program, so I can tell you how successful it was. Overwhelmingly, the thousands of kids who have gone, inner city kids who have gone out to these affluent suburbs, not a long bus ride, by the way, typically 20-minute, 30-minute ride.
We got it, but cross those lines, keep crossing those lines. Jonathan Coase, I'll stand by for just a moment if you would.
Okay,
the new book is The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. I want to get another perspective on this. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Amy Wilkins. She's principal partner in the Education Trust. That's a Washington-based advocacy group that lobbies on behalf of poor and minority students, funded by groups like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Pew Charitable Trust, John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, names you've heard funding public broadcasting. She helped write provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act of 2002. Amy Wilkins, thank you very much for joining us.
How are you, Tom?
We're great, and I know you've been listening in from Washington. So here we are. You know Jonathan Kozol and the passion he brings to this issue and has for many, many years. How does his message hit your ear today, Amy? Is he describing the picture accurately? And what about the prescription that he brings?
Well, I think that Jonathan describes really, you know, powerfully what too many of us see in urban schools on the same things that break Jonathan's heart break my heart. What Jonathan misses is the fact that there are many high-achieving, high-poverty, high-minority schools that I see regularly. In fact, if I didn't see those schools, you know, every day, it might, you know, I couldn't get up to come to work every morning.
High-achieving, high-poverty schools, so it's not a problem, or there's hope?
But that we know that while integration is a goal that we should all work toward, that there are in the interim, as we work toward integration, we can't sort of give up on high achievement. We can't conflate the two issues. And that as we work to get schools more integrated, there are things we can do to ensure that those kids who are currently in high poverty, high minority schools can achieve at higher levels. So I don't think that, you know, we can ask minority kids to wait as we sort of for high achievement until we achieve the kind of integration that Jonathan and I both hope for.
And in that interim, you're pointing, I guess, to testing, to No Child Left Behind, and saying this is the safety net. This is the point of the spear that will prod what's actually there to better performance. Have I got that?
What we think is that No Child Left Behind is a measuring tool. It is a measuring rod. It does not and will not. Laws don't educate kids. Teachers educate kids. And I couldn't agree with Jonathan more that what we really have to do, the highest priority, is to put very, very good teachers in our high-poverty, high-minority schools now. You know, right now, the kids who need the most from their schools are getting the least from their schools. And so if we as a nation could sort of face that fact and say that we need to dramatically up the effectiveness of teachers in high-poverty schools, we would all go a long way to leveling the playing field for low-income kids and kids of color.
But go with testing for now, you say. The country can't wait in what you describe as the interim before integration. I'm curious how we get back to that.
Well, you know, one of the things Jonathan said earlier was that he's seen bigger crowds come out to see him than have since the 1960s. I think one of the reasons for that is No Child Left Behind has focused the nation's attention on these kids in their schools in a way we haven't had a focus in the past. The focus alone, I think, is something that we should all be grateful for, but the fact is, you know, despite what Jonathan says, we are seeing real gains in the reading and mathematics scores of kids in high-poverty schools in a number of states.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jonathan Kozol, you hear the pushback there saying, well, fine, and our hearts are broken too, but here's a reality. And if we don't push with testing, you don't expose the problems, you don't give a sort of life preserver to the kids who are out there right now.
Well, first of all, I have all the respect in the world for Amy and Amy Wilkins. In fact, I better, because her father is one of the people I've loved most in the world for my entire career. And he helped, he joined me in launching this book in Washington at a press event a couple of weeks ago, the great Roger Wilkins. Mm-hmm. There's simply a couple of blunt points I have to make in response to Amy.
All right.
Number one, I do think Americans have to be very blunt in asking themselves the following question. Have we, in fact, decided to give up, to rip apart the legacy for which Dr. King died, and to postpone any struggle to achieve it for, you know, another century during
the legacy, the goal of integration?
Yes, it was very
of little
clear.
Black kids and little white kids and all the rest.
That's right. Dr. King's dream is blurred every year on his birthday by politicians who love to stand up and say, I too have a dream. But they never say what his dream was. His dream was very explicit. You know, have we basically agreed to give up on that dream for another century and meanwhile to experiment with ways to polish the apple of apartheid by, you know, having inner city kids wear uniforms and march along the corridors and chant incantations of self-help and all the other projects that I see in these totally segregated schools and drill them remorselessly to try to get 5 percentage points increase in their test scores. Is that it? If so, we ought to say that. We ought to say bluntly, for now, America has given up on all of that. We've given up on Brown, and we're out to create slightly better version of apartheid schooling.
Jonathan Kozol, stand by. Amy Wilkins, I'm sure you have a response to that. We will be back after a short break to get it. Listeners, you can join us. What do you think? Is your child in a segregated school? What's the impact? Is No Child Left Behind the answer? And do we still believe that separate but equal is impossible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the re-segregation of America's urban schools and its meaning for the country. My guest is Jonathan Kozol, author of the new book, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. And from Washington, D.C., Amy Wilkins, principal partner in the Education Trust, Washington-based advocacy group that lobbies on behalf of poor and minority students. Amy Wilkins, I want to go straight to you because Jonathan Kozol, in typical fashion, has come out with a pretty heavy broadside here. He says that essentially the No Child Left Behind Act and its efforts are polishing the apple of apartheid and blowing up the Martin Luther King dream. What do you say?
I'd have to say that Jonathan is wrong. You know, we should, again, pursue the goal of integration. Dr. King's dream remains a dream for many of us. But as we pursue that dream, we have to keep our eye on the prize, which is African-American, Latino, and low-income kids who have the sort of academic skills that they need to make their way in this world and to join the continuing struggle for a more just and fair society. That said, I also think that Jonathan has to be careful in putting up integration as a panacea for what ails American education.
Why exactly? What do you mean?
You can go to an integrated school anywhere in this country, and what you find is, in fact, under the same roof, you have two schools. You have white children in the high-track classes, those gifted and talented classes, the AP classes, and you find minority kids in the remedial low-level classes. So simply putting those kids in the same building doesn't solve the education problem that I'm out to solve, which is ensuring that black kids and white kids have the same level of skills and eliminating that gap that Jonathan talked about, the fact that black and Latino high school kids getting ready to graduate from high school have the same skills as white eighth graders. We can't assume that just because we put them in the same buildings that they're going to get the same level of education. So yes, we should pursue the dream of integration, but it is not in and of itself sufficient to ensure the goal of high achievement for all kids.
Jonathan Kozol, integration's not enough, and if you wait around for it, you condemn a generation of kids who maybe testing will help.
Well, first thing, testing teaches nothing. Testing is not a substitute for teaching. I can assure you that. we're very busy now weighing our lambs, but that's not the same as fattening them. The fact of the matter is, on the point that Amy just made about integrated schooling, sure, if you want, and a lot of white people point to this, you can say, well, it's not perfect. There's some internal tracking in some of these schools. That's right, in some of them. And there's also still unconscious bias on the part of even self-consciously liberal school officials in these programs. Still, overall, across the nation, if you look at the results of schools in which black and Latino kids are integrated with white children in the system, across the board, 90 to 95% of the kids, I'm talking about these inter-district programs in Boston, St. Louis, et cetera. 90 to 95% of the black kids in these programs graduate high school in 4 years and go to four-year colleges, compared to a figure of approximately 30-40% at most in the segregated schools they left behind. The point about integration is not to compare it to perfection. It's to compare it to the opposite of integration.
But in the meantime, Amy Wilkins says, don't leave those kids without something to grab onto. So if No Child Left Behind is encouraging teachers to teach them...
It isn't, though. I mean, the large crowds that are turning out to hear me, as you know, Amy intuited, are not coming out because they've been awakened to the problems that inner-city kids face by the tests mandated by the White House. They're coming out because they're infuriated by the madness, by the mania of adding a whole new level of tests, starting in some districts now in kindergarten because the principals are so scared.
And extending soon to high school, President Bush would say.
These teachers are coming out because they're going crazy, finding that a quarter of the school year is devoted to giving the tests, prepping the kids for the test, drilling them for the test, they don't get the results back until the end of the school year, so they are absolutely no use to teachers while they're teaching these children.
Amy Wilkins, Jonathan Kozol looks at the testing and No Child Left Behind and says this is a positive menace and suggests that it's also diverting the country from doing the things that would be more substantively effective. What do you say to that?
Well, Jonathan found, I believe, you know, bad instruction in inner city schools long before No Child Left Behind.
That's much worse
now. In 1968, Jonathan was finding schools in which low-income and children of color were wasting away, literally, intellectual wasting away. I would certainly agree with Jonathan that there is some very bad instruction going on in schools. I would also agree with Jonathan that at times some of this bad instruction is the misguided efforts of principals to respond to the challenge of No Child Left Behind. But what we find is that the schools that are getting the most gains for their kids are the most dynamic and interesting learning environments, doing the things that Jonathan talks about, having kids, little kids, read real literature, Eric Carle, A.A. Milne, that the older kids are, in fact, reading Shakespeare, learning to make, you know, doing real hands-on science experiments, that's the way you get gains for children. And yes, those schools that are drilling and killing are doing no favors to anyone.
Thank you, Amy. I agree with you. Thank you.
But at the same time, what we are finding is that high-level instruction, deep instruction, instruction that is full and rich in content, gets children to high levels. And what we have to do is really provide assistance to those principals and those superintendents who are desperate to do better by their kids but don't know how. And we have to introduce them to rich and deep curriculum so that they have an alternative to the drill-and-kill stuff that they are flailing and reaching out for.
Even when they're separate populations, we have so many callers who have been waiting patiently to join us. I want to begin to turn to them from Buffalo, New York. We have another Amy calling. Hello, caller Amy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Kozol, it's an honor to speak with you. I have two issues that I would like to address. One is resource-based and the other is culturally based.
All right.
Now, you know, King's legacy was integrationist, but also, and this is what he was assassinated for eventually, was the Poor People's Campaign about resources, giving resources to the poor. Briggs v. Elliott, which later became Brown v. Board, that was also emphasizing resource equity and integration. That was later lost when we got to Brown v. Board. My fiancé teaches at an Afrocentric charter school. Mm-hmm. Now, the school is 98% black, and it's extremely well-funded, and the teachers are paid much more than average teachers. Performance has increased, and more importantly, there's a great cultural and racial awareness in that school. There's a greater emphasis on African-American history. Culturally speaking, there's African drum and dance.
So what are you saying? Integration doesn't matter. As long as you've got the resources, it'll be fine. Separate but equal can work. Is that the lesson you're drawing?
I think it can. I think separate but equal can work and is better for students of color's self-esteem.
Okay. That's a respectable point of view. There are a number of folks who feel that way, but I will tell you bluntly, I don't. I disagree. I'm an old lion. And
Amy's fiancé is there. He's teaching. They've got 98% African-American school population, and she says it's working.
Well,
with great resources.
Look. In any city in America, I can always find one or two totally segregated schools which, for unusual reasons, usually because of a highly charismatic principal or an unusual cluster of, of hyper-energized young teachers, for whatever reason, or because of an outside donor giving them extra money, can come up with good scores for a short period of time. The fact of the matter is that history has proven to us that this does not work on a wide scale over a long period of time. Segregated schools were never equal to the schools that serve mainstream kids throughout the last century of our history. They won't be in the next century.
Even if they get the same resources, even if that somehow magically occurred?
First of all, they never will get that. They never have gotten the same resources on any long-lasting basis. Mm-hmm. What happens is, in order to buy off segregated people, we temporarily offer them a little extra. We'll give you a pretty library. We'll give you a few, we'll give you a few extra programs.
Yeah.
Look, let me read the words of the Warren Court in case people have forgotten.
All right.
Brown. One sentence. We come then to the question presented, does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal opportunity? We believe it does. In the field of public education, separate but equal has no place. Mm. If this young woman, the other Amy who just called us, wants to disown that, she's free to do so. But then she has to be blunt and honest with herself and young people and say, I'm giving up on Brown. I want to go back a century to Plessy versus Ferguson.
Amy in Buffalo, thank you for your call. Amy Wilkins, please.
Yeah, Jonathan, this is the other Amy, the African-American Amy.
Hi, Amy.
Who says, Jonathan, that I absolutely believe with you that, again, we have to continue to pursue the goal of integration. And I believe that deep in my heart, and my father believes it deep in his heart. But as we do that, we cannot say to African-American children or their parents, you have to wait for high achievement until white people get ready to go to school with you and to send their children to school with you. We cannot wait for white people to get their acts together on race to give these kids a good education. I am not going to link the fate of my son, my 3-year-old son, to white people's whims and white people's racism.
And, you shouldn't, of course.
And what do you take from that, Amy, that the No Child Left Behind path is necessary, otherwise you're simply waiting?
Yeah, that we have got to do something to boost the achievement of these kids. And admittedly, as Jonathan says, laws don't teach children. Teachers teach children. All No Child Left Behind does is hold schools accountable for teaching these kids.
Okay, good.
It does not, in fact, teach them. And what we have to do is get the kind of teaching core in high poverty, high minority schools that will give these kids a chance as we continue to work towards the goal that Jonathan and I share.
Amy Wilkins, let me ask you, because we're talking over very broad expanses of time here in this hour, do you believe then that integration will ultimately happen again? Because Jonathan Kozol points out, we've gone the other way. We've got these high 90% all black and Hispanic students in many urban schools. Do you believe that will happen? Or do you think that even if it doesn't happen, if you pursue the No Child Left Behind path, it will be all right? Is it a black pride issue at some level?
Well, I think we are talking over a large expanse of time, and frankly, integration is by and large a white people problem. White people have to look into their souls and decide what it is that causes them to move away from people who look like me, to educate their schools in where there aren't very many people who look like me. And as I say, I can't, nor can my son, wait for white people to decide that they've made some serious mistakes over time and correct their behavior before we get a decent education.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jonathan Kozol, are you then saying, what do you say to someone who doesn't have your dream solution?
Okay, let me
whose kids are in school today. They're saying, my God, what am I supposed to do? I want at least some proof that something is going in
here. Look, I work with these kids. I'm not a paid teacher anymore, but I feel like an unpaid sub because I'm in so many schools and teachers. Like in Los Angeles, not long ago, I walked into a class of 40 minority kids. Teacher handed me her class to teach. So I know what's good. I see this. First, I'm afraid Amy is falsely polarizing my position. I don't give up on anybody here and now. I'll do anything I can to help any gutsy inner-city principal or teacher to win any victories they can here and now. But I insist that adding another layer of testing on top of the testing that already exists in every state is useless. The second quick point I want to make is this. If Amy has any influence on the people who are implementing Mr. Bush's testing law, No Child Left Behind, here's something that ought to be proposed. I disagree with Amy that it is white resistance that is preventing inter-district integration from happening on a large scale, because all over the country, white people support these programs and protest when they're cut back.
So what is it, the cost of gasoline?
They're being cut back because the federal government has gone to court to discourage the use of public funds to allow kids to ride a short bus trip between black and white districts.
But that government does not exist in a vacuum. I want to get one more call. It's been so hard. It's been so good. Tom's calling from Orlando, Florida. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Hello, Tom. Are you there, my friend? Oh, poor Tom. He waited so long.
Could I just finish my sentence?
Yes, please.
The point is, in NCLB, No Child Left Behind, there is a clause saying that if a school is failing, minority kids are allowed to transfer to a better school.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a worthless provision, because in all the cities in question, there are no better schools, or there aren't enough better schools to which they can transfer. So less than 1% of kids have transferred. If anybody who has influence with Mr. Bush wants to do something wise, good for the kids right now, and
Jonathan,
also good for the country,
yeah,
it would be to permit transfers across.
Amy Wilkins, what do you say to that?
Let me just finish my sentence.
Yes.
Permit transfers across district borders so that areas like St. Louis, Milwaukee, and Boston could increase integration to the suburbs and not have to abandon it because of federal policy.
We've got it, and Jonathan, we've got 1 minute left. Amy Wilkins, what do you say, please?
Jonathan, I did try in No Child Left Behind to put in a provision that would allow the kind of transfers you are talking about, and we lost that provision, lost it largely because of the opposition of suburban Democratic representatives. But again, even though I lost that provision, which I think is terribly important and effective, I'm not going to give up on trying to boost the achievement of these kids in the schools they are at today. Yes, we'll continue to work to get the kind of provision that you and I both want. But again, in the meantime, I am not going to waste 1 minute of these children's time while we wait, again, for people to decide it is okay for these kids to attend other schools.
Okay, I agree with you. I don't give up on them either. In fact, the last chapter of my book, which you'll get to with joy perhaps at the end of all the gloom, describes precisely some of the schools you describe, not the testing part, but beautiful schools in inner city neighborhoods where somehow they resist all this B.F. Skinnerian stuff and still have what I call treasured places in which children can not only do well on exams, but also get some pleasure in the years of their childhood.
Well, it's a big sweep and a big picture. We're happy to see that glimmer on the other side, but what a battlefield in between. Amy Wilkins at the Education Trust in Washington, we're very grateful to you for being with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. And Jonathan Kozol, we thank you for your reporting and for the new book, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.